Welcome to In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. Today we have our resident uranium expert, Justin Hune. Justin, thanks for coming back on the show.
Happy to be back, Steve. Good to see you. Good
to see you too, sir. As always, we are not financial advisors. Do not take this as financial advice. Do your own due diligence, and this is simply what Justin and I are doing. If you enjoy these videos, please smash that like button and hit the subscribe and bell notification. All right, Justin, last time we were on, the spot price of uranium was around 48 bucks. Now it's just a hair above 51. Uranium equities, it's kind of neat to see that the uranium price only moves a tad bit, but the equities can just be an exponential move on that. Sput's discount to NAV has narrowed significantly since the last time we were on. I think the biggest I saw it was like 17%. Now it's probably floating around 1 or 2. What's your general outlook on the uranium market as it stands now?
Oh, well, the uranium market I'm super bullish on. You know, the actual timing of when it's going to take off is difficult, but I do tend to think it's this year. We're basically essentially waiting for some demand to trickle down from the enrichment conversion markets, or I should say enrichment conversion services market down to the U308 market, which it will. I think that we're going to see a lot of long-term contracts still signed this year. And that demand is coming. It can't not arrive to U308. So it's not theoretical. It's not some pie in the sky thesis. If you buy conversion, you buy enrichment, you have to buy uranium to feed into those contracts. So we're already seeing the conversion and enrichment demand significantly increase, especially in the Western providers of conversion and enrichment, because Western utilities are not signing any new contracts with Russia for either service. The Western utilities, to my knowledge, continue to receive deliveries of Russian uranium under legacy contracts. How long will that last? I don't know. Will that be cut off from one side or the other? I don't know. They don't know. But as of now, new contracts are being signed pretty heavily in the conversion and enrichment markets in the West by the West, and that will trickle down to U308. So I've never been more bullish or more confident in where this is going. And this is not like, oh, you know, in the past, you know, 2017, 2018, you knew that eventually we'd work through a bunch of above ground inventory and eventually that demand would come back to the market. We'd see a long-term contracting cycle, et cetera, et cetera. But it's very, very difficult to time. Now we're actually seeing that demand in the conversion enrichment market. So it's coming and it's coming. We're not talking 2 years from now. We're talking, you know, maybe 2 months from now, possibly even less. So in the meantime, you know, the uranium equities, they popped pretty hard on the Japan accelerated restart news. And interestingly enough, they didn't really fade that news. They just kind of stayed strong and kept moving. They're getting hit today. Oil's down pretty big today. The broad markets are weak over the last 2 days. Today, they're kind of flat-ish. But, you know, we tend to kind of get coupled along with other elements of various markets when the movement in the spot price is not very strong. So right now the spot price has trickled down a couple of dollars over the last week and not a whole lot of volume happening there, but it'll happen. And so my confidence there is very high. In the meantime, you know, we're going to get washed around a bit by the markets, I think.
I'm hoping I got some limit orders in that I'm hoping hit. We'll see.
You and me both.
You mentioned Japan. Rick Rule's been saying for years that the catalyst in the uranium market will be when Japan restarts its nuclear fleet. And I think everyone watching our channels, you know, has known that this is coming, but we didn't know when. And now we do. It's this year and next year, right? And on the end of August, the Prime Minister of Japan publicly stated that they're going to do just that. And so we have the answer now. And the part that gets me on this is that this is a country that the only one in history that has been bombed literally by nuclear. And they have the most recent nuclear incident with Fukushima. And this is the country that is restarting all their nuclear power plants. I don't want this significance to get lost on our subscribers. Can you kind of take a couple of minutes and just go over that, how significant this is in this market?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think that probably the most significant aspect of it is the fact that the Japanese public is now majority in favor of restarting nuclear. So, and that, in a lot of ways dictates the language coming from, government officials. So the new Prime Minister Kishida has had, the most aggressive language in terms of accelerating restarts that we've heard in a long time. But even without him being elected and his most recent comments earlier this year and even into last year, they were still saying to meet their, carbon neutrality goals, let's call it. I don't know if that's exactly what they call it, but their carbon emissions goals, they want nuclear to be 20 to 22% of the grid by 2030. And that's 7 years away. And that's another 20 plus reactors. And so they've already restarted nine. Originally, they had 54 online. They now have 33 that are operable, and that includes those nine that have been restarted. So they could, in theory, restart, what is that, another 24 reactors. But really, it's, we're waiting to kind of see the wheels hit the pavement here, in terms of that actually happening and seeing a follow through on it. Right now, it obviously makes sense for them to do it, so I'm not necessarily doubtful that they will. There's still a decent amount of inventory in Japan, so it makes sense for that in that way. Natural gas prices have skyrocketed, coal prices have skyrocketed. That's Japan's primary energy source at the moment. They obviously want to expand renewables as well, but we all know how that goes if it makes up too much of a percentage of the grid. And I think the Japanese are probably smart enough to avoid making that blunder that Germany just went through. So yeah, it's quite significant. It's pretty, I mean, the messaging to your point, I think, is really significant too. So, with them having the most recent accident in most people's memory, and still deciding to go back to nuclear, is pretty substantial in terms of the rest of the world that is either in some sort of phase of shutting down their existing plants, or has never touched nuclear, or is considering bringing on nuclear. Seeing Japan make that move, I think, is a big vouch for the technology. And they have just, I mean, unbelievably proud craftsmanship in that country, and the fact that they've constructed these marvels of engineering that are sitting there idle that basically solve their to-be energy crisis. Of course, they want to restart them. So it's just a matter of going through those processes, and they've ramped up the stringent protocols for bringing the plants back online. So not only do they have to go back through substantial, whether it's not renovation, just checks on how earthquake-proof the reactors are. So by the way, that earthquake that caused the tsunami that caused the Fukushima accident, that was a huge, as a 9-point something earthquake. I mean, it's absolutely monstrous earthquake, and every single reactor in the country completely withstood that earthquake with no issues. It was the tsunami that caused the problem at Fukushima. Excuse me. And so they're going back through the safety checks, the emergency checks. They're doing kind of anti-terrorism sort of checks. Obviously, tsunami, backup systems, if that ever happens again, God forbid. And then lastly, they're requiring that the communities surrounding each plant are in favor of the restart, right? And so that has to be a certain distance from the plant, 30 kilometers, if I recall correctly, something like that. So all of those things have to be in line. So, a lot of these reactors filed for approval for restart 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and they're still going through these processes. So the fact that they want to accelerate that now is a good sign, and the fact that the people are behind it is a good sign. So, and Rick Rule, he kind of nailed it in a way. I think that obviously the market made its first leg up over the last 18, 24 months without that news. So now we've had a big reset in terms of valuations on these equities, and now we have this positive news coming through on top of bifurcated markets and China saying they can do 10 plants a year and all this other stuff. I mean, the list is so long, but yeah, it's good news for sure.
Yeah, it okay, so that's an example of a country that at least in my opinion is heading in the right direction. What is Germany doing right now? What's it like over there as far as them with energy? I think it was you that said that they're taking timber from the United States, turning it into wood pellets, and they're burning that to keep warm this winter. Is that
Yes, I actually just retweeted somebody's tweet earlier today that was sharing photos from old growth forests that are being clear cut for the ESG approved power generation in Germany that they're calling green energy. You know, they're basically making wood pellets out of these old growth trees in North America and shipping them to Europe to burn, to boil water and create electricity. It's absurd. So you can, I don't have it right in front of me, but yeah, that's still happening. As far as Germany's nuclear, they have three operating reactors currently. They're set to phase out in December. The latest I heard is that two of those three reactors might be kept online for emergency use only through April. So as far as I can tell, they're still considering decommissioning their last three remaining reactors. If not in December, you know, next year.
Yeah. In April. Well, okay. All right. This might be a selfish question, although we have a lot of listeners in California, so probably not. Okay, California. Love the state and the weather. Not a fan of the politics. I'm getting almost daily alerts on my phone about, you know, conserve power. Yet at the on the other side of the coin, they're cramming electric vehicles down our throats. I don't know if the governor thinks that they're going to be, you know, these cars are going to be charged by magic or fairy dust or what, but as I understand it, we have one operational plant, Diablo Canyon, correct?
Correct.
And we have other plants that have been decommissioned. I've got five on my list here, but maybe there's only, can any of these be restarted? San Onofre, Humboldt Bay, Rancho Seco, Felicitos, Santa Susana?
No.
Can't.
San Onofre is the most recent decommissioned plant, and there's no way that's coming. I mean, it would be less work to just build a new plant than to refurbish any of these. And I think that honestly, SMRs fits that bill better than building large reactors again in the state. But no, none of those are coming back ever.
Okay, I thought San Onofre was good. It looks like it was decommissioned in 2013. That one, it's just sitting there done.
Yeah, it's done.
What's the problem with it? Is it just not up to snuff as far as earthquakes or something? Or?
You know, I don't exactly know because I'm not a nuclear engineer, so I don't know these things down pat. But there's certain elements of the actual reactor facility that once they're decommissioned are very difficult to bring back online. And also, you know, we're talking about a decade of no maintenance on what has yet to be demolished and removed from the site. So these things take maintenance and it's right on the ocean. It's dealing with a lot of rust and a lot of just, you know, it's my understanding coming from somebody who is part of the process of decommissioning at the plant right now, which I heard from more recently is like, no, it's never coming back. I mean, that's not even on the table talking about bringing it back online, you know, politically. So yeah, there's basically no hope for that. There certainly is hope for Diablo Canyon. I mean, they gave it a 5-year life extension, which passed almost unanimously. There were a few nay votes, but the Democrat majority legislature voted to approve that. And I'm sure that they took a nod from Gavin Newsom, who wanted to keep it online, probably for his own political reasoning, really. So, but you know, you still have to celebrate that such a far left leaning state politically is keeping their last reactor online. So I'm very, very pleased to see that. That's another 5 million pounds of uranium demand from that 5-year extension. So that's something, and certainly they're going to have to go into the market for it. We had recently even Senator Jennifer Granholm the Department of Energy director. She was talking about building new nuclear in the United States, and she even mentioned specifically California. So who knows what happens going into the future. I would love it if logic prevailed and we actually would embrace. I think SMRs with desal plants is an absolute no-brainer in this state. Absolute no-brainer. A state that's faced with drought, that has a huge, very long coastline, plenty of perfectly safe, perfectly suited locations to place SMRs. And desalinate ocean water and run that and pipe that in and, you know, reforest the desert and feed, you know, water to its gigantic population. But I'm definitely celebrating all of the hard work done by the advocates trying to keep Diablo in line, and the fact that the political establishment here approved it is fantastic.
So there's no other nuclear power plants in California that are currently being constructed. Nothing.
No. No, it's all solar. All the new stuff in California is solar, 100%. Yeah. To my knowledge, I don't even know if they're building any new natural gas plants, or they might be expanding wind a bit, but they're raising hundreds, if not thousands, of acres of desert and installing solar, which is why we've been getting those notifications. I mean, finally the weather cooled down substantially, but last week, you know, we got 3, 4, 5 days in a row where we got notifications. I'm sure you got them too. Basically begging people to use less electricity between 4 and 9 PM. And, cause that's when the sun goes down and they don't have, I think there's 14 gigawatts of solar at 100% capacity. So on a fully sunny day, if in theory it was 100% capacity, which is not, but in theory, between solar, because it's not only solar photovoltaic, but they also have a concentrated solar where the mirrors reflect light and boil water.
Yeah, that one on the way out to Vegas, right?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And so that's I believe it was 14 gigawatts of total solar capacity, and there's less than 1 gigawatt of battery capacity. And at its best day ever, it ran, I think, 800 megawatts. Of battery capacity, which is a lot, you know, that's significant. You know, Diablo Canyon, I think, is 2,300 megawatts. But when 14 gigawatts of electricity capacity, let's say it's running at a, you know, 70-80% capacity when the sun is at 2 PM, when the sun is overhead and it's the heat of the day, the zenith, I guess, you know, noon or 1 o'clock, and they're getting 12 megawatts from it, and then they get zero, you know, 4 or 5 hours later, and there's no battery backup. Then they have to ramp up all of the natural gas. They have to ramp up the imports that are coming from out of state, you know, Palo Verde in Arizona, the largest nuclear reactor in the country, just across the border. So they're getting some from there. They're getting from natural gas in the state, and they're importing energy as well. And they're trying to ramp that up as much as possible. Meanwhile, it's still 100 degrees at 7 p.m. and everybody's running their AC. And the funniest thing from this whole debacle was that within a couple of days of each other, there was, you know, a news headline that came out that was basically California to ban new gasoline engine vehicles in by 2035. And then like 2 days later, it was like California asks electric vehicle owners to not charge their vehicles. Oh, man, it's like you can't make it up. Yeah, it just goes back to that stupid or liar question. You know, it's like it's one or the other. It's got it. It's one or the other. And I don't think these people are stupid. So I think they're maybe willfully ignorant, but it's just political games. It's pandering to a constituency. And I hate to say it, but you know, the majority of the population in the state does lean that direction. It's like, they just think electrifying everything is good without spending 5 minutes to think about what that means, whether it's the mined minerals or the batteries or the waste or any of that. That doesn't matter. It's just like, oh, Teslas, more Teslas for everyone. That's got to be good, right? Yeah, it's frustrating, but you know, yay, nope. Diablo.
That's the cost we pay for the weather.
I know it's tough. You know it's tough. It's so geographically spectacular state.
Apparent to even my buddies who have no interest in, no matter how much I talk about uranium, I've out of 10 of them, I've only got one of them to invest in, URNM and URI. And they saw that too. You know, just as an average everyday guy, they're like, wait a minute, they want us to turn off our AC, but on the other hand, they're asking us to buy electric vehicles. This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've paid attention to the weather over the years. I paid a lot of attention to it when I was farming about a decade ago. And, you know, I remember we had, and this was in June, which was very early to have this kind of heat wave. We had 3 weeks in a row of over 100 degree heat in my town. And there was never any problems with the grid. There's never any alerts about the grid. So it's the prevalence of electric vehicles, which are now only 3 to 4% of the total makeup of cars on the road in California. And it's already causing a problem. And the much, much increased percentage of the grid made up by solar. Those two things combined, they don't work together. And so that's what's causing this problem. And every year, the panic about the heat ramps up more and more and more. And it's like, you know what? This is the coolest summer I've ever experienced in my life in this town. And we had, what, 6 or 7 days in September of 95 to 105. That's a normal year. If anything, that's a cooler year than normal. And so, you know, I don't know. The climate panic is endlessly frustrating for me sometimes. It's like, yes, I do think that there's a lot of environmental degradation. And I think a lot of that is coming from burning fossil fuels, especially coal, at the levels that we are. And I think that we should try to reduce that. But I think that blaming only carbon on every single thing that happens in the weather anywhere on the planet is unbelievably ignorant and misinformed. I don't know, that's a side rant. It's just frustrating in California to see it, like every year the panic notches up a level when, you know, you're going to have record heat and you're going to have record cool temperatures in various places every year. And the climate changes, it just does. It's not to say that we shouldn't try to live in a more clean way going forward, which I believe we should, but it's mostly politics. It's very, very difficult to separate the politics from the actual science. That's the hard part, I think.
Yeah, I agree. What, and just a quick, what's the total supply that we're pulling out of the ground as of now, and the total demand? Is it like 125 and 200 or?
No, well, the actual structural demand is much less than that, coming from actual operating reactors. You know, it's more like 175 million pounds a year for global reactors, total consumption of the U308 equivalent. And supply this year is going to be somewhere around 130 million pounds. So it's still at least 40, if not more, million pounds a year, and this year, short in terms of supply. Now, in the past, there was a lot of there was some inventory drawdowns and there was secondary supply that made up a lot of that difference. And the difference also soaked up a lot of above ground inventory. So we're now year four of having a structural supply deficit. You know, the first couple of years, you know, soaked up for Cameco to not produce from MacArthur and then be buying in the market kind of has a doubling effect. And so that really helped a lot. And Cameco, they claim their actions alone accounted for 100 million pounds of uranium that would have been produced that was then, you know, not produced essentially. So there's about a 40 to 45 million pound structural deficit. There still is some secondary supply, although this year that is changing drastically. There's still definitely, you know, the Russians are definitely still underfeeding at their enrichment plants, and that underfed uranium is not going to be sold to the West, which is 70% of the global nuclear fleet is in the West. So that's not happening. But the UF6 that comes from that underfeeding, they'll keep for their own reactors. They'll keep for their build out book, which they still have significant. You know, the Finns kind of reneged on their contract after the invasion of Ukraine, but they still have plenty of contracts for exports, for reactor exports. So they can use that underfed uranium. They can sell it to whoever, right? They can sell it to all their customers in the East, which they will. But in the West, the enrichment in the West, no underfeeding. So you got to figure that's at least 10 million pounds of secondary supply that was there last year that's not there this year. So that's pretty substantial. So we're really, and then you add, you know, when you talk about 200 million pounds, now we're talking financial demand on top of structural demand. So, you know, Sputz purchased, what is it, 17 million pounds or 16 million pounds this year. So if we add that, you know, now we're looking at 190. And then any other financial demand, you got Yellow Cake that did some purchasing, I believe, or at least it did the raise for it. You've got this ANU Energy that's starting up in Kazakhstan. They had $50 million raised so far. They're going to do a $500 million follow-on raise in Q4 or Q1. So that's another 10 million pounds. So once you add up all the financial demand, which, you know, you can't really model that for next year or years out because you just can't predict what the money flows are going to be like, what the market's going to be like, what the price of uranium is going to be, and how that compares relative to the money that was raised for the purchasing. But we know there's going to be some. So, and this year we're probably going to hit 20 million pounds of secondary demand. So you now you're pushing 195 million pounds of total demand, primary and secondary, and 130 primary supply. Let's say secondary is probably going to be 10 to 15 million pounds of secondary supply. east and west, but we're talking east and west for that primary and secondary demand as well. So we're talking 195 to 200 compared to, let's say, 150. So we're still looking at 40 to 50 million pounds short with all of that considered, which is huge. It's 25%. Yeah. It's huge. It's huge. And we know the above ground inventories are getting thin, especially of U308 and UF6. So yeah, it's wild times.
Yeah. But good for uranium investors.
Yes. Yes. Honestly, it's been good for a couple of years, and I think it's about to get really good. And I'm not saying tomorrow, but I'm saying over the next, let's say 18 to 24 months, I think we'll have a pretty epic run and possibly beyond. I mean, we're not going to see expanded enrichment in the West for many years. I mean, Urenco is talking about getting their facility up and running by January 2024 to build more centrifuges that they can add to their cascade. This is their facility in New Mexico that they're going to get going by 2024. So, I mean, we're looking 2025, 2026, I think is absolute best case scenario for more enrichment capacity in the West. So, and I don't really see this situation shifting in terms of the market bifurcation, at least not in the near term. The one thing with the bull market that's hard to predict, but is certainly possible, is the financial flows and the secondary demand, right? So if we have a bunch of money pile into a really thin market, then we could see a drastic price overshoot and have that come back down and settle at a price that makes sense for the market. That's exactly what happened back in 2007, you know, it shot up to 134. Then it crashed back down, I think, to like 60, 50 or 60. And then it started to rise again back up to whatever that natural demand was. And that was, you know, 2008, we're talking, it bounced back up into the 60s and even 70s, I believe, before Fukushima, over the few years after the recession. So yeah, but I think that this bifurcated market's going to stick. And I think without trying to predict what's going to happen with money flows and secondary demand, we should see a multi-year run in the price of the commodity.
Thanks. You just brought up something that a listener asked. Joe asks, what is bifurcation and how does it apply to the uranium market?
So the market, there's essentially going to be two separate markets. I mean, to put it simply, east and west. And the most of, because of the war in Ukraine, because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Western utilities, Western fuel buyers. And so when I say West, I'm talking essentially about the OECD countries. It's like the OECD versus the BRICS. So the BRICS countries is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and then Argentina and Iran both applied for BRICS this year. It's probably going to be more countries leaning that direction simply for energy availability, most likely is what I'm expecting. But as of now, it's about a 70-30 split for the nuclear world. Terms of reactors that exist and are operating now are in the OECD. OECD is about 70% of the total global reactor fleet. And the problem is
OECD
that
OECD is Canada, US,
Europe. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Australia, New Zealand. Yeah, exactly. Although they don't have any nuclear demand, but yeah. And so basically what's happening now is Russia, all these utilities in the West essentially are cutting themselves off from signing new contracts with Russia. Now, Russia doesn't play a big part in U308 production. And it's primarily, they've got a couple of mines in Russia that have a reasonable amount of uranium production. And then they have some good JVs. Uranium One has some good JVs with Kazakhstan. But they're about 14, 15% of total global. I mean, that's still significant, but relative to their service, the nuclear fuel services, it's insignificant. They are around 30 something percent of global conversion capacity and about 40% of global enrichment capacity. And enrichment is really important because it's the next to the last step of getting your actual fuel in the reactor. And so over the past decade, utilities could buy a lot of their nuclear fuel by going straight to enrichers, because if there was reduced demand and there's a lot of above ground inventory, the enrichers had excess capacity And they're using that excess capacity to underfeed and re-enrich tails. And so you could actually go straight to an enricher and buy UF6, skip the U308, skip the conversion, and go straight to the buying UF6 or even EUP if it was enriched uranium product at the percentage that you needed. Well, that aspect of the fuel cycle is now essentially cut off from the West. And it's not officially cut off. Like I mentioned, that a lot of Western utilities are still receiving legacy contract deliveries from Russia. We don't know how much longer that's going to go. The US DOE is definitely making strides towards establishing a complete fuel cycle in the United States. Now, we obviously have U308. We got plenty of it. We got one remaining mill, but we got a bunch of, you know, there's a dozen ISR facilities. Most of those are in Wyoming. There's a couple in Texas. We have a conversion plant that will be operating next year. That's the Metropolis plant in Illinois. And we have, Centrus is an enricher, but they primarily deal with Russian feedstock. And there's not a whole lot of capacity. Urenco is enriching, but they only have 4.7 million SWU, and the United States needs substantially more than that. So we don't have a complete self-sufficient fuel cycle yet, but they're working on it. They're trying to, they're putting $1.5 billion additional on top of the Inflation Reduction Act budget to purchase high assay, low enriched uranium and low enriched uranium. So basically the DOE is going to be a buyer of enrichment to help support enrichment expand in the United States. That's really important. But as of now, I know this is a long answer, sorry. As of now, there's most of the demand for nuclear fuel is in the West, and a minority amount of enrichment is in the West. And so this is why it's really important, because all that demand is coming to the Western enrichers, and they can't expand capacity very quickly. But what they can do is they can overfeed their centrifuges by going out in the market, buying uranium, which they're doing right now, by the way. Officially, they're doing that. That is happening. That's not theoretical. It's happening. The enrichers are buying uranium so that they can overfeed their centrifuges, which basically that means and I think we covered this a little bit in our last talk, but just for the sake of answering this person's question, the waste material in the enrichment process, the tails, it's not really waste, but for whatever, you know, let's just call it that right now, that has a certain amount of the fissile isotope still in it. And the amount of spinning and the amount of time that the UF6 spends in the centrifuge, they dial in a certain tails assay to dictate how much of that material will be left in the waste. And that will dictate how much SWU or energy to enrich and how much feedstock they have to put into the centrifuge to get out the desired amount of enriched uranium at the desired level of enrichment. And so that tails assay, the amount of U235 that ends up in the tails, last year was running at 0.18, 0.17, 0.19. It's already, they've already bumped that up to 0.24, 0.25, which is roughly about a 15% increase in feedstock. And so they have contracts at the old lower tails assay, but they're bumping it up and they're taking the hit because they're charging more for SWU, they're charging more for enrichment, and they're signing contracts out in the future at an even higher tails assay. So the utilities that are signing contracts for 2025, 2026 enrichment, they're probably signing those at 0.28, 0.29, 0.3. And that means much more feedstock. Now we're talking 25 to 30% more feedstock than 0.18 to run at 0.3. Utilities have to provide that feedstock. So you sign that contract with the enricher, then you have to go out and source that uranium and get it converted into UF6 and give it to the enricher. So now they're basically, the overfeeding is really where the rubber meets the road here. And that's drastically increasing uranium demand. And so this bifurcated market, if the West will continue to contract for conversion and enrichment in the West with Urenco, with Orano, with Cameco for conversion, that means much higher uranium demand, because 70% of the world's global uranium demand is now going to be signing enrichment contracts at 0.25 to 0.3 SWU, tails assay. So that's a big, big jump in uranium demand. And the utilities that are signing those contracts now, because there's so little UF6 out there just sitting in a drum at a conversion facility, they can literally cannot go out and source UF6. So they have to buy conversion. Well, if you buy conversion, you have to provide, in the same way, if you buy enrichment, you have to provide the converted uranium, the UF6. You buy conversion, you have to provide the U308. So utilities that are signing conversion contracts with Cameco and with Orano, they're signing enrichment contracts with Urenco and Orano, they have to go out and buy uranium because they can't skip that process anymore. And a lot of the smart utilities are already well covered in long-term contracts, but a lot of them are not. And so all of that conversion, increased demand in the West for conversion enrichment, they have to go buy that uranium and run it through the fuel cycle. And, you know, any utilities that are uncovered 2025, 2026, that's basically tomorrow, because we're talking about, an 18-month to 24-month fuel cycle. So the bifurcation of the market. Now, Russia is likely to continue to operate at the levels they were already operating at. I haven't heard anything about them reducing their operations. So what that means is their cost of conversion is going to drop. Their price of SWU is going to drop. They're going to have probably more underfeeding. But all of that uranium is, like I said, is likely to stay either in Russia, go towards their export book, or actually feed some of the Eastern demand. So that might be China. China has their own enrichment, but I'm sure they'll buy some from Russia. But it's a minority amount of the demand that's going to be accessing that material. So you have the majority of demand seeking material from the minority of production is basically what we're talking about. And we're working on an updated supply and demand model. I think we're going to have that, at least some rough numbers from that out in our webinar next week, but it's looking, the demand numbers are pretty much off the charts from, and I don't want to put a number out there yet until I feel more confident in our math, but it's big. It makes the supply deficit that we just covered a few minutes ago look small. Yeah.
So what I hear you saying is, okay, the BRICS nations, their demand is about 30% of annual supply. And the West is
demand.
The West is about 70% of it. But as far as where this is, the conversion and enrichment takes place is on the wrong side. Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah. So there's enrichment in China, and the Russians have, they're the largest producer of both of those services. And so for the largest provider of those services to essentially not be doing business with the largest consumer of those services, it's really what's causing the big shakeup in the fuel cycle. Yeah. And is what is causing. So for example, I'm going to mix these up, but that's okay, because you'll get the point. Spot conversion, if I recall correctly, is up over 100% this year, and long-term enrichment is up over 100%. And then spot enrichment is up almost 100%. Long-term conversion is up huge. UF6 is up. So all of these elements of the fuel cycle that are closer to the actual end product, they're all up. Because if you're a utility fuel buyer and you are foreseeing a potential problem in supply, the first thing you're going to do is secure the services that are closest to the actual need. If you could just go out and buy your fabricated fuel, you just do that, right? And in some cases, in the past decade, when there was excess enrichment capacity, the enrichers could actually just underfeed. They could create that UF6, or they can re-enrich their tails up to UF6, and they had UF6 on hand. They could enrich it, fabricate the fuel, Bob's your uncle. And they could skip, not all of them all the time, because still you're only talking about 25 million pounds of underfeeding supply when everything was running as it were, you know, let's say 2 years ago. But yeah, you seek out the final stages of the fuel cycle first. And that's exactly what's happening right now. So the enrichment conversion are seeing substantially increased demand, and that's going to, and there's also complications with discussing contracts. So you have a utility that's, you know, as much as possible, they want fixed pricing so that they can consider their budget going out into the future. You know, like, they'd like to know what they're going to be paying for uranium in 2027 when it gets delivered. And if you're a producer and you're in a country, you know, I mean, there's inflation everywhere, some worse than others, but you know, if you're a producer, how would you even lock in a price for 2027, 2028, 2029 delivery? Like, how do you even decide on that price in the world that we're in right now? So these are very complicated conversations that are happening between producer and utility, but they are happening. I mean, Cameco is telling us they have more pounds under consideration for contract and active conversation with utilities right now than they've had since Fukushima. So the utilities are acting and they're going to the Western providers that they can trust that are reliable. And that's been Kazatomprom. There's a little bit of hair on that one, but I think they'll figure it out. I think that there's definitely some swaps happening with China's inventory. I think that they're trying to work out a shipment path, in my opinion, and this is not confirmed, but they're probably going to try to work out a shipping path through China to ship out of China to Western buyers, instead of trying to go through Port of St. Petersburg, which some of that still is for the utilities that are accepting deliveries from Russia, which is a declining number. But their route going west through the Caspian, it's like they cross the Caspian and they want to go to the Black Sea or straight to the Mediterranean. So their options for that are go through Ukraine. That's not going to happen right now. Yeah. Go through Azerbaijan and Armenia, which are actively in a hot conflict at the moment. Or go through Iran and Turkey to get to the Black Sea, or go through Iran, Iraq, and Syria to get to the Mediterranean. So there's no great way for them to easily move this material west right now. And we're seeing that actively, but they'll figure it out. And they're doing the best that they can. I'm confident that they're going to figure it out. They're not in an easy position geographically or geopolitically. But and China, you know, sorry to rant on about this, but everything just leads into the next thing. China, Xi Jinping just visited Kazakhstan and made a statement yesterday or the day before, basically saying China will always support Kazakhstan and their sovereignty, essentially is what he said. So he's like, regardless of what world politics look like, we got your back.
Yeah.
And so they're obviously a key country for their Belt and Road to ship goods into Europe and a very vital source of uranium with their build outs, which are massive. You know, they're talking about going, you know, they can easily do 6 to 8 a year, but they can ramp that up to 10. And they're going to have to do, you know, 8 to 10 a year to get to their goal of 200 megawatts by 2035, which is unbelievable. It's insane how fast and efficiently they can do this. It's like crazy.
Yeah, I want to share the screen right here real quick, just so listeners can kind of get an idea. So here's Kazakhstan, just surrounded by Russia, and right now they're which way are they going? Are they going through here, through the sea, and then out this way to the west? And they have.
I mean,
to...
that's the route that they're working on. So they're, you know, their success. It's easy enough for them to get across the Caspian, which is that first big body of water there to the west of Kazakhstan. But bordering the Caspian to the north is Ukraine, or to the northwest is Ukraine, and below that is Azerbaijan, and below that is Iran. And so there's problems there. They'd have to go through Azerbaijan and Armenia, or Azerbaijan and Georgia, or they go through Iran and Turkey. And I guess they could go through Iran and Turkey and get to the Mediterranean, but I don't know that that's necessarily as easy as it sounds, and it doesn't sound that easy.
It might be easier for them just to go over here through China if they can establish that route. They do it just by train, I guess, or
by train. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, is that Kazatomprom? Okay.
Yeah.
Right on. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Follow Justin's work on uraniuminsider.com. Check out his YouTube channel, Uranium Market Minute. You can sign up for his newsletter. It's awesome. Please like and subscribe the video, and go to stevebartonmoney.com if you want to check out any of our past episodes. You can contact me, stevebartonmoney@gmail.com or stevebartonmoney.com. Right on. Well, thank you, Justin. Enjoy the rest of your day, and I will talk to you next time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.